So tonight we'll stay together. And I mentioned last week that these last 2 weeks, tonight and next week, which will be our last week, we'll look a little bit more closely at the forces in our lives that tend to really charge our relationships, like sexuality, indifference, cultural conditioning, power. And I think it's useful for me especially, but for all of us to have a real sense of humility, because, you know, to be talking about these things, or even when we on our own are looking, being mindful of these things, we have to appreciate that we're, you know, we don't know what we don't know. We're not seeing what we don't see. But that doesn't excuse us from being interested and investigating and talking together. It's really hard to imagine how, as human beings, we would learn how to relate skillfully with each other if we didn't have some curiosity about what we could call sexual energy or sexuality or power or just the effects of cultural conditioning and the fear we have around difference and the, you know, ways we feel safer when we're around people who seem to be like us. And these, you know, and all these little and big ways have a governing effect on our relationships, and more than that, just on the experience of happiness and unhappiness. So I did look up sexuality in Wikipedia to express my humility around this subject. What is sexuality? They say, human sexuality is the capacity to have erotic experiences and responses. So then I looked up erotic. It's like that. You know, one thing leads to another. I mean, we kind of know what it is, but it's the boundaries aren't very clear with things like when we talk about sexuality or erotic tension or sexual desire or lust. And, I mean, maybe when we were younger, you know, it was like there were moments when, oh, yeah, that's what lust is, or that's how sexual energy is charging this interaction I'm having with this other human being. So we tend to want to think about it or talk about it just in that extreme. And assume then all the other times we're not a sexual being, or it's not part of who we are as a human being. And we feel like, you know, if we get that part under control, learn how to refrain ourselves from those, you know, really charged moments, or just have them with a socially acceptable partner, then we don't have to be interested in this aspect of our lives or this aspect of our being. So just to start unpacking it, you know, one, and always, of course, thinking about it in terms of our relating to another or to others. But as we've been finding, you know, we're always relating to the moment, and we're relating to the body in the moment, and we're relating to the stories in our mind in the moment, moment by moment by moment. So we're always in relationship, and we're always relating to each other, even if we're not around each other, because I have a story about you that I'm relating to over and over and over again. So one thing that seems to be true about sexuality and how it might be charging our relationships is it has something to do with pleasure. So hopefully that's not rocket science to you. You know, like, yeah, it has something to do with pleasure. And there's this thing that's not that hard for us to begin to recognize the tension and release. And this is not exclusive to sexuality. You know, we play this game in a way, though mostly unconsciously, where we allow, the mind allows tension to build with the anticipation of a time when that tension will be released. We can do it around longing for a vacation or a partner or some sexual activity. So you can just, this is so important in all of our relationships, is to have a sense of how the mind, consciously or unconsciously, bring it into the conscious realm, mindful realm. How is this mind playing the game of tension and release? It's not necessarily bad, that game, but we want to be conscious of it because it can, you know, obviously create a lot of suffering. I mean, athletics can be this. Even observing athletics, you know, really wanting a team to win, we create this idea in our mind, I really want this side to win. And then when they win, there's that release. I really want this to be over, you know, whether it's the course or my cold. You know, just already I've had it for a few days now, and every time my life energy starts to move again, I go, oh, I'm getting better. And then the disappointment. So there's that play with sexual energy too. And it's just interesting how we often casually allow it to play out in so many relationships, that sexual tension. And even in relationships that, you know, maybe the odds are very, very, very low that we'll ever sort of actually have a sexual interaction, with an outward sexual or physical sexual interaction with the person. But, you know, flirting or teasing or playing in that way. And just to have a sense of what we're doing. Like, are we playing with fire? Because that game of tension and release, it's like, on some level, the mind expects release. Expects, and it will, like, I noticed that too, if I really wanted something, or if that, like, even that sexual energy had gotten stimulated in my mind, it's like, I need to throw the mind a carrot of some sort. Well, you can have chocolate. Or you can do this, or you can do that. And we probably all know what it's like when we're playing that game of tension and release. When life doesn't provide the release. You know, we get irritable. And, I mean, all kinds of difficult mind states, despondent, feeling betrayed, or whatever. Another thing, as I was reflecting, that seems part of sexuality is this dynamic of power. That I don't know if this is inevitable, but maybe it is. But there seems to be a play, or not a play, but a expression of power in a lot of our a lot of aspects of our sexuality. And obviously, we don't have to read the news. It's amazing how, you know, the statistics say how common it is for there to be sexual violence. As I've been thinking about this the last few days, I've tried to put myself in other people's shoes, like walking, for example, walking to the building in the afternoon, and I was thinking about some of these things, and a younger woman it was walking toward me. And, you know, just getting a sense of what is it like, you know, I wonder what it's like from her point of view to be meeting a guy that she doesn't know, you know, on the street. Not that I looked particularly dangerous or it was dark. It wasn't dark or anything like that. But, you know, I just kind of getting the difference in experience. There's an interesting video. I might have mentioned it in this class. I happened to see on this, I think it's called Upworthy. Maybe some of you know that website. And there was this French video where they changed the genders. So there was a guy who was taking care of the kid, and the wife was some hardworking professional. And but anyway, he got abused by some women in a way that would be more typical the other way around, men abusing, harassing a woman. And he reported to the police station. It was provocative in a lot of ways. It wasn't a perfect video, but it was interesting. It was definitely, I appreciated seeing it. But one of the powerful scenes was the guy reporting it in the police office, you know, talking to a female police officer. And of course, everybody in the office, almost everybody else in the office was another female. And here he's talking to her about being harassed by other women. It was just so interesting to have it turned around. So, I mean, this is just one expression of power in sexuality and, you know, just the physical strength and physical domination. But there's a lot of place for emotional power in sexuality, too. And using attraction to get something, to get what we want. And all the little and big ways. You know, somebody likes us. Somebody's attracted to us. And what do we do with that? What does responsibility look like in that situation, or what does integrity look like in that situation? Some of you know this well-known Zen teacher in the country, Jan Chosen Bays. She's an abbess of a monastery outside of Portland. I think it's called Great Vow Monastery. She's also a doctor, and I think she's worked in the area of kids who have been abused. She's written a couple of things about sexual harassment. There's a couple of words that she said. The precepts have been compared to dikes in a rice field. They hold back and channel the rushing water of our passion so that life is not flooded, so that smaller and more helpless creatures are not harmed and the harvest of our life's efforts is not ruined. These precepts prohibit those actions that have a bad outcome and cause harm to ourselves or others. Almost all, maybe 99.999% of the time. Then she asks about, well, what about that other 0.001% of the time? Because it always seems like, you know, especially when we're in the charge of that tension and release dynamic, it always seems that this maybe is okay. This time it's okay. She talks about how the Dalai Lama was asked about this once, like in terms of a teacher having a sexual relationship with a student. So kind of a classic power dynamic. And he said, yeah, maybe it's possible, but that person should be able to drink urine and eat feces, meaning their level of transcending aversion and desire would have to be at that level if someone is going to be able to be in that kind of a relationship without taking advantage of it, taking advantage of the power differential. She goes on a little later in this article. She says, from the Buddhist point of view, sexual harassment is rooted in a fundamental misunderstanding of who we are. If I believe that I am the subject, the center of the universe, then everything else is the object, the means by which my needs are met. Everything else, then, is used to affirm my separate and special existence and to relieve my fear that I will stop existing. Another aspect of sexuality seems to be it's related to the tension and release, but I think it's at a different level of subtlety or a greater level of subtlety. But it's this awareness of bodily energies. And I think a lot of it, I think it has to do with a couple of things. One is that often in our sexual relations and our sexual activities, the mind's more concentrated, so we just happen to be more aware of the body, more sensitive to the body. And then I think also it's a really strong energy, so it's just easier to be aware of and to concentrate on. And especially because it's pleasant. And, you know, pleasantness is the ideal. A pleasant object is the ideal concentration object. The mind can really gather itself. And then this is really an interesting place, like to get this part of sexuality, you know, the kind of the coming alive of the body, as opposed to feeling like it's a heavy weight that we have to drag along through life, the body, dull and unresponsive. And I think this also, understanding this part of sexuality, like the coming alive of the subtle energies of the body, it actually, I think, can help us work with sexual energy other than the obvious ways of having sexual relationships. Like, there may be other ways to bring the body alive, like eating chocolate, or being physical in different ways. Dancing, moving, playing, and to learn how to let these energies move freely, which is sometimes part of that joy of our actual sexual activities, when the energy is less congealed, I guess you could say. The physical energies of the body are less congealed. We can think about these energies of the body, you know, that's nature. And the particular nature of the energies of the body are to move. That's their nature is to move. And we have a funny and neurotic relationship with the energies of the body. On the one hand, we're mostly obsessed with the energies of the body. And on the other hand, we're in a way afraid to let them move because we'll lose control. We don't know that experience of just things moving. Some of you might know in French, you know, the word for, or the phrase for orgasm means the little death. And there's a sense, you know, when the bodily experience is really intensely pleasant, there is a little death of the self because it's so attractive when the bodily sensations are intensely pleasant. It's so attractive to the mind that the mind is willing to let go of everything in order to be there for that pleasant experience. And so this is it's related to experiences of rapture, too, that some of you have had in your meditation or just bumped into in life in different places. It'd be nice, you know. It's so nice to have places in our lives where we can talk about these things. I was just thinking some examples of my life, and then I thought better about sharing them. And in a way, it's too bad that I have, you know, fear and mistrust, and it's just not that common and not considered appropriate to talk about these things. And you see what this is about. This goes back, brings us back to the first part of sexuality, the tension and release. I mean, part of what propels or causes so much of an dark underbelly to sexuality is this investment we have in tension and release. Because when we make it culturally make it bad, then it has more of a charge. And then, in a way, you know, funny way, it has more of a release when we sort of break that taboo or, you know, do what we shouldn't be doing. So I'll tell you anyway. Are we recording this? I can just do this, right? And, you know, especially in Buddhism, but in meditative circles, we talk all the time, you hear all the time about sort of weird energy experiences that people have. And so much of our fascination with sexuality and what gives it a charge, it's one of the few places we feel the force of nature in a more intimate, primal way. And it's always here. I mean, where would it go? And why are we so distant from it? You know, it's really, I mean, it should, I think, break our hearts, this ossification. You know, we learn to distance ourselves from nature. And then we more and more neurotically crave to be part of nature. There's a really beautiful chapter in Reb Anderson's book, Being Upright, he's talking about the 16 bodhisattva vows, and they're similar to the five precepts, they're just in a more expanded form. And so there's a chapter on not misusing sexuality. He says, how does sexual greed arise? Self and other are seen as separate. We project reality upon separation. From a belief in the reality of this perception, the peaceful mind of the oneness of self and other is obscured. This belief wounds our consciousness, and the wound is a source of anxiety and pain. A powerful impulse arises to reunite the split mind. If this other were really other, then we could live without being in union with it. But because it's not really other, our yearning is very strong. Sexual greed is powerful because at its root is this deep pain of separation. We will do almost anything, grab onto anyone, if we feel it will help close the painful gap and heal the wound. We must recognize that in our wounded state, we are dangerous to ourselves and to others as well. Acting out sexual greed is actually a form of stealing, sexual stealing. The precept of not misusing sexuality is concerned with reversing this process of wounding. It points a way of turning from sexual stealing to sexual healing. A little later, he says, in this lifetime, we are all sexual beings. In order to realize the enlightenment of the Buddhas, we must be intimate with our whole sexual being, moment by moment, standing, sitting, walking, or lying down. We vow to be intimate, to be upright with this great ball of fire. If we turn away from our sexual passion, then we freeze and beings are harmed. If we grab it, then we are burned and beings are harmed. But if we just stay close to it, walk around it, always in touch with the fact that we are sexual beings, neither identifying nor distancing ourselves from our sexuality, then we gradually become intimate with it. From this intimacy, appropriate sexual conduct spontaneously emerges. We know this infinite warmth and love are there, but we do not reveal it until the time is right. We vow to stay upright, to stay close to our passion, constantly working with it, dancing with it. It's always there, and we are present too. It may get stronger or weaker according to circumstances, but we are working with it all the time. So another related aspect to sexuality seems to be, and it's not different than the other things we've talked about, but something to do with safety. It's like and not safety in an ultimate sense, but a kind of grounding where sort of the glue of a committed relationship. This is something that you and I share. So we've got this pact. We're in this together. This is our glue. The sexual relationships, something we share, just you and me. And then we get a sense that commitment provides some sense of safety for us. Like a secret pact. You've seen my body. You've touched my body. I let you touch me. I let you be intimate with me. And vice versa. So we can look at that sense of safety. You know, we hear that a lot culturally, like, oh, you'll cheapen it. And I think that's what people, you know, right or wrong, that's what people are pointing to. It's that you'll lose that sacred bond, that sense of safety that some people seem to be able to get. Then the other aspect of sexuality is like a means or a place to express friendliness and play and like loving affection, kindness, pleasing each other, making another person be happy, even if it's a, you know, relatively temporary happiness. But there's this whole, I mean, obviously this is part of our sexual lives, is that learning how to make ourselves and each other happy and have a pleasant experience. And we get a lot of, it has a sort of a shadow side, which is when life feels dull or boring or not important, then I'll do this. I'll have a sexual encounter. And it may, I see this a lot even in my relationship with my wife. It's like, what is the initiating energy? Is it just because I'm bored? Or like, I deserve a reward? Life is hard, so I deserve a reward. Or is it a more natural, like, consensual play? And just a beautiful way to express affection and kindness and appreciation. And the last thing that came to mind as I was sort of unpacking my own experience of sexuality is just more of a sense of, I don't really like using the word the divine or sacred, but I'm not sure of a better word, but just a sense that a way of putting, going beyond what feels superficial. And, I have to say that, this is more of a rare event than a common event. And it's interesting how, those times, they aren't easily replicated when you want to replicate them. When the act of lovemaking or whatever you want to call it just felt like a kind of beautiful meditation or a release that was more than physical, or a letting go that was more than just physical, more than just physical pleasantness. So these are some of the different pieces that seem true in my life as a sexual being. It's pleasant. There's this dynamic of power that seems to come into it. There's this revealing of a subtle energies of the body, and it's a great mystery. It's an interesting, we're naturally interested in these subtle energies of the body. And when these subtle energies move, it always feels good. And when they appear to be stuck or there's a resistance, it always feels not pleasant. And there seems to be something on some psychological level around safety that gets played out in this area of our lives, and something to do with basic friendliness and affection and kindness and play in this part. And I think it can be, as much as any activity, a spiritual experience. But there's a lot of cultural and other kinds of conditioning that we have to learn to not be confused by. And just want to talk about that a little bit before I open it up for discussion. Some of these forces that shape it, like, for however many millions of years, or billions probably, because it's not just in terms of human sexuality, but, the genetic code has been driven by this reproductive force. And so that's obviously playing itself out here, whatever that is. And then there's all the cultural programming. And of course, the two are not unrelated. And I don't know if we could ever unpack what's cultural and what's genetic or distinguish. I mentioned the whole thing about, the naughtiness of sex that's, you know, of course, culturally based. And just, you know, related to culture is also this whole psychological process of creating an identity for ourselves, gender identification, whether we identify in a more binary way or in a non-binary way, but one way or another, we're using sexuality to kind of create an identity that we then use to relate to others in the world. And that, of course, affects how we dress, how we present ourselves, our body language, how we use power, how we use language. All of these things, you know, we can't really tease out what's, you know, part of some sexual expression and what's part of every other social dynamic. You know, where does my, you know, from my identification point of view, maleness, where does that end and where does my humanness begin? Or my being white, or my being, you know, well educated, or my being an American, or being affluent, or being, you know, all these other identifications. What's what and what's the other? It's not like they exist in separate categories. So we have this huge psychological and cultural programming, genetic programming, huge forces that we know, we can know clearly that they're there, but not really get to the bottom of them. I mean, we see them expressing themselves, but doesn't mean we can, that we can sort of stop being surprised by them. And then just another aspect of this and how it plays out in terms of our relationship is just this fixation on youth and the relationship between sexuality and youthfulness and all that that does and how we look at each other and how that relates to status, you know, and all the things around physical appearance and the way that we judge and evaluate and hate. Sally Tisdale wrote an article, Nothing Special, The Buddhist Sex Quandary. This was long ago in Tricycle, I think in the early 90s. She says in that article, I've come to believe that there is something in the nature of sex itself that is capable of disturbing the most disinterested of minds. And this is important because even if you feel that your sexuality is pretty staid or under control or whatever, you know, just we participate even as spectators, which is participating. You know, just reading about the Catholic priests or reading about, you know, where we go on the websites, and what news articles we tend to be interested in. I mean, clearly, when you see, I mean, people who advertise and people who market things and try to manipulate people, they know what they're doing and they always use sex. You know, sexual ideas and sexual images. So we have to own this and not be ashamed of it or afraid of it. We have to sort of see this. And I think one of the best ways is to learn how to talk about it with each other and just to find those circles where you feel safe enough to begin to talk about. And initially, it probably means talking about our fear of talking about it. And our fear of being honest about it, and our fear of even looking at it. Or there's just so much pain and shame. I was talking to somebody recently, and this person was conveying a time long ago when they realized that it was pleasant to touch themselves. And so they were pretty young. And so they told their mom, and you know, the mom being dealing with her own stuff said, don't do that. And, you know, and this person was like so amazed that the body could feel good. And isn't it interesting that, you know, and clearly, you know, many of us, through our own sort of exploits, have realized that it isn't an end in itself, this kind of energy, whether we're acting it out alone, masturbating, or seeking out sexual experiences, or seeking it out through stories or novels, or wherever, you know, living inside of other people we see in the movies. Clearly, that isn't satisfying. It's not an end in itself. But being afraid of it also isn't an end in itself. So this is the interesting dynamic we find ourselves in. You know, like Reb Anderson says, this great ball of life energy. I think that's actually maybe a more useful way to talk about it, a kind of life energy. And, you know, one of the things as you're sitting practice develops and you get into more subtle states, you know, you feel the energy moving, and it really becomes clear. It's not just a statement you hear, but the energy just wants to move, and it will find a way to move. It doesn't like being stuck. Culturally, genetically, biologically, you know, one of the ways energy moves is through sexual activity or the sexual act or sexual release. So it's really interesting to explore like other ways for that energy to move. So maybe it can come out of the heart, or maybe it can express itself in any number of different ways, so that the whole body, the whole mind, the whole heart comes alive, like the energy isn't stuck moving in only one way. Let me just finish reading this. She says, sexual desire is a matter of psyche, the body, the emotions, the ego, and an animating life energy together. It is irrational, inconvenient, often unexpected, and sometimes so illogical, so overwhelming as to seem mad. So I could talk about this for a long time, but I wanted to save a little bit of time. So we have about 15 minutes. And, yeah, just any questions and experiences, and you know, we're looking at the, in particular, looking at the charge you've experienced, the sexual charge that comes up in our relationships, and how to navigate that. How so often we're unskillful. How in those times when we've navigated it in a way that seems skillful, what were the supporting causes that allowed us to be skillful with sexual energy in relationship with others? Or anything that comes to mind around this topic? Yeah, Tim. When you're going to get stuck.
I
Yeah, thanks, Tim, for sharing. Yes. Yeah, thanks, Sharon. Other thoughts? Yeah. The plot, P. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but those more transcendent moments, at least in my experience, were completely ephemeral. And this is a thing about why I think celibacy can be really powerful and useful. But what I don't think is useful is somehow bypassing the whole experience of being a sexual being, because one way or another, I think we have to see it for what it is and also see it for what it isn't, that it isn't a salvation. And so if that requires a lot of sexual experiences, great. I don't think it necessarily has to require a lot of sexual experience. But I think one way or another, we have to see it for what it is, because then we can get on to what real freedom is. And, you know, culturally, we make it into something huge. And so we have a cultural burden to go beyond that. And this is what, you know, one of the reasons the aging process is so disturbing for us, I think, is that, you know, I'm sure a lot of you see this, that so many of those possibilities start not seeming likely anymore. You know, whatever those possibilities were. So then what is the meaning of life? Because early on, having those special experiences, that's was the whole point of being alive. And then as we see that, well, I'm not that likely to have those amazing special experiences. So in a way, and I think you're probably, that was Wellwood maybe who said that. I'm not sure, it could have been the woman that I read from last week, Piper. But anyway, I think we have to be disappointed if we've had conditioned into the mind expectations, then we have to grieve the loss of that idea or those ideas, that as a salvation, whether it's some kind of perfect relationship with another human being or some kind of perfect sexual experience or any kind of utopian vision. It could be a communal experience, a vision or expectation that somehow the common ground community is going to be so harmonious and so skillful together. But we have to understand that on this level, life is messy and disappointing. And we have to grieve the loss of utopia and perfection in order to be real and in order to be free. Because freedom isn't about constructing a utopia or having a perfect experience. Freedom is in the heart not resisting the way it is. That's the freedom that we're interested in. Thanks, Steve. Yeah.
Sexuality, you are being one with nature. And I think it's the heart mind stops because the mind and the heart become one. When you are in fact engaged in real intimacy in which there is love. And it needs to come together, and that's why the mind stops, because there's nothing for it. It is the heart.
Or in Buddhism, we might say it's the absence of greed, anger, and delusion in the mind. So we often talk about it in the negative because it makes it a little bit more, it helps to operationalize like what the practice is. Instead of trying to find the heart, we're learning skillful means for the mind abandoning its identification with greed, anger, and delusion. Yeah, Patrice. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's probably acting itself out, not just in our sexual relations, but all the time. That whole thing about safety and, you know, what is the cost? What is the danger of being revealing, being open or truthful? And that's sort of what I was picking up too, just in passing that woman on the street. It's like it's a total different experience for her. I've been kind of observing this over the years, of course. But like, you know, we have a pretty friendly neighborhood. And it's always interesting to me when a woman who's alone will actually raise her head and make contact and say hi. Because a lot of times they won't. And sometimes they will. And I'm sort of beginning to comprehend that difference. It's a very different world that means a very different thing than when I do it. And this is another thing you're pointing out, another thing, which is, it's like, it's not easy for us because of gender differences, but also because of, we don't know people's backgrounds and how they've been wounded or hurt or whatever, empowered in their lives. And so it's really hard for us to read, like, each other's body language and other words. We have to end it here. It's 9 o'clock. But we'll have small groups next week, so hopefully the conversation will continue. And the other thing we'll talk about next week is we'll look at conflict and resolution of conflict. And in this context, we can talk more about difference, cultural conditioning, and power, which obviously there's a lot to say there. So let's just take a few seconds and let go of the words. I appreciate being together. And thanks, everyone.